Good evening. We're going to be sharing one microphone this evening, so bear with us. Can you hear okay in the back?
Yes.
Is this loud enough? Good. We could probably dispense with this, but I don't know. In deference to people who are approaching my age, maybe we should have a little amplification. Well, welcome to the Languages of the Land, a Dialogue with Salter Grove exhibition. I hope you've had a chance to see it when it was up in its full glory about 10 or 15 minutes ago. If not, the schedule is on the postcards in the back, so you'll be able to come back at another time and see it when it's up, and also when the tape is running, which has voices of people talking about this special place in Warwick. On behalf of the Warwick Museum of Art, I'd like to welcome you all here, and I'd like to acknowledge the importance of the people who fund these kinds of projects. The New Works program at the Rhode Island Foundation was a major funder for this exhibition, as was the Rhode Island State Council on the Arts. The Rhode Island Council for the Humanities has funded these three panel sessions, and so we really thank them very much. Without their generosity, these kinds of projects just would not happen. They're not money makers by any means. I also like to thank the Patuxent Village Association for helping fund this project as well. It takes a community effort to get these things going, and we've certainly had a community effort. So on behalf of Holly Ewald, who's the artist, and myself, my name is Michael Bell. I'm a folklorist. I thank you all, and I appreciate your attendance tonight. This is the first of three panel discussions. The next two will be on the succeeding Wednesdays. This one is on the history and the folk life and oral traditions of this area that is now known as Salter Grove. And what we'd like to do this evening is put it in a wider context and take you all the way back to the time before recorded history and talk about the importance of an area such as this along the Upper Bay. Technically, of course, Salter Grove is not on Narragansett Bay. I think it's the Providence River, which is sort of brackish water. But we all call it the Bay. To us, it's the Bay. I'm just the moderator this evening, and it's my privilege to introduce three very knowledgeable people. There's Ella Seketau, who's ethnohistorian for the Narragansett Tribe of Indians. She's going to talk a little about the prehistory and the early history of this sort of area and its importance to the tribe. Also with us is Bill Simmons, who's professor of anthropology at Brown University, who's written extensively on the archaeology of this area and also on the native culture of the area. He's going to fill in that context for us. And then, of course, if you know anything about Warwick history, or you read the Warwick Beacon, or many other publications, you know who Don D'Amato is. He's the official Warwick historian. And he's going to talk a little bit about the shoreline in Warwick and its importance in the historical development of the city. And of course, Salter Grove is an important part of that shoreline. I think there must be something like 35 miles or so of shoreline. And so if I'm not mistaken, Warwick has the most shoreline of any city or town in the state, which is amazing to me. So let's begin. Each speaker will speak for about 10 minutes or so. We're not going to hold their feet to the fire and make them quit if they're into some interesting discussion. But we'd like to leave time so that you can ask questions. And
if I use the microphone, I'm going to hear my own voice coming back at me. And sometimes it's a bit confusing. My name is Ella Seketau, and I am a member of the Narragansett Indian Tribe. I wear many hats. Ethnohistorian is one of them. I am also tribal medicine woman and tribal genealogist, and I'm the head consultant for the Historic Preservation Office. When I talk about the past, everyone has to visualize the things that I talk about. In this particular place, where there was a large population of the ancestors of mine, the place was very, very important because of its position, summer and winter, where the summer and also to where the
real salt water was, because in this particular area it's brackish water, and the aquatic life is slightly different than what it is where the salt water is, and where the sweet water joins this Providence River. I believe that's what it was formerly called. In the summertime, there was the activities that had to be accomplished by the ancestors for their survival through the winter months. The seasons were divided up into four and 13 months, which is a little bit different than the calendar of 12 months that we have today. And it was represented by the 13 moons of the 365 days of the year. From April until September or early October were the busiest months. I call them the seven good months of the year. And in this particular place, where there was so much activity, taking advantage of all that there was in the sweet water, the brackish water, and the salt water, the people were able to survive throughout the winter months. In the warm weather, the homes were individual and closer to the water sources. And in the winter months, they would move back away from the winds that come along with the water and into family longhouses. Appanag was one of the favorite winter places as well as summer places, and where there were great quantities of oysters that were harvested by the people. Besides the saltwater fish and the freshwater fish runs, and I talk about both of them because that is where the Atlantic salmon and other species would go into the shad, would go into the freshwater where they would lay the eggs, and the next population of eggs would provide great quantities. We Narragansett today still value the what we call buckies or alewives, or the shad movements that come in the spring and in the fall, and it has became a way of life for us, where there were the areas that we no longer had the privilege of going because of where we lived. There's a great history of what happened after the European invasion of the 17th century. Where the summer homes were, there also needed to be the areas for the garden, where the corn, beans, squash, pumpkins, melons, cucumbers, and sunflowers were raised. And then where the winter longhouses were, a bit inland and on high ground, where the people would live together. Numerous families, all related to you on your mother's side, would be in one longhouse. All of the longhouse areas were surrounded by palisades, and at first, when people saw them, they thought it was because of the protection of people against people. However, many of the modern-day people don't understand that in this area, which was under the sachems of the Narragansett, there wasn't that worry. It was to keep out the weather and to keep out the animals. Most people don't believe that there were bears and wolves and the big cats, which we called, which my parents called catamounts. There was also deer and moose and elk, and a few of the wood bison. There were all of those things, plus all of the smaller game animals, both aquatic and the land, and the birds of the air. And the unique thing about what has become the state of Rhode Island and Narragansett Bay, there were two types of turkey that were prevalent that most people are not even aware existed. There was the bronze turkey, and there was also the white turkey with black tips on his feather, which were the Narragansett turkeys that were just along the coast and on the islands in Narragansett Bay. When you stop to think of all that was here and no pollution, there were the existence of very healthy people, some who lived to be over 150 years old because they did not have to contend with all of the diseases that were brought in by the European invasion. And in some of the records that were written, they talked about the old people of being in their 40s and 50s and 60s, and that was leaving off the century of years that they had lived before then, because of the great health and all that was available for the people to be to have a healthy survival. When the homes were built in the summertime, they were built so that a small family of people could live there very comfortably, and the summer homes were used for storage as much as the storage pits, which were on higher ground and closer to the longhouse settlements, wherever they were, and they were numerous in this area. The population of the people was well over or close to 100,000 people for the Narragansett alone. And this was calculated at first by the number of men and the number of women. The women outnumbered the men 3-1, and the children outnumbered the women 4-1. So there was a very, very large population, and not at all like what was written about there being only 2 million people in all of what became the United States and parts of Canada. And the other thing is, we like to talk about, is the territorial boundaries of what the Narragansett sachems were in charge of. In what became the state of Connecticut, twice as big as what became the state of Rhode Island, more land than that in Massachusetts and in southeastern Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, what was to become those states. And that was the territorial boundaries that were under the auspices of the Narragansett sachems. And their goals were to protect the land and have the survival. The only other thing that was unfavorable to the Narragansett people and to others in the area were the new people the new Indian people that came in this area prior to the coming of the European settlers. And that was the nations of the Iroquois people. And they were much farther north, and the Narragansett had very good relations with the Mohawk people. So there wasn't that threat that was there for other tribes that were farther inland than what we were. And there was a trade. The Indian people didn't war against each other to the extent that it has been written in some of the books, because all of the tribes had governments, and they had the governments that was very, very similar to what the government of the United States is today, where there were the kings and queens, and then the sub-chiefs that came underneath them, and then the people, and it was extensive. In your history books, for anybody that does research, you will read about one sachem, and there was always two, the older one and the younger one. At the arrival of the Europeans, there was Canonicus and Myantonomi, Myantonomo. It's written down several ways. And there was very little written about the Sunk Squaw sachems because of the European practices where the men were the priorities and they owned everything, including the women and children. And very little at first was in any of the females' names. However, in the Indian societies, it was the women who were in charge of the taking care of the homes, and the men were the protectors and the providers for such. And there was an equality which was practiced by the Indian people. The Narragansett were a matriarchal, and there was a reason why things have changed over the centuries. And of course, the Indian males have fallen into the priority where they are more important than the females. And it is something that we still know that it's the women who are the backbone of the communities. And we still know that is the reason why it was considered matriarchal. And we know why in the history books that were written by non-Indians, women, only if they had interactions with the colonists and with the non-Indian populations, were written. Otherwise, they were mentioned as the old female queen, or no names were ever given, where there were many in all of the families. And there was much to be very grateful for. And the Thanksgiving of 13 months was practiced by all of the people because of what was given and the importance of Thanksgiving to the Creator. And just one more thing I have to mention is the fact of the religious and spiritual beliefs of the people. There was only one Creator or one God, whom we Narragansett still call today as Kautantuit. And there were the creations, all of which were done by the great Creator. And a soul or a spirit was given to everything, whether it was animate or inanimate. And therefore, the new people coming in, when we and our ancestors recognized the spirit of wood, fire, stone, trees, and whatever, they thought that the Indians were worshiping gods when they were just talking about the spirits of such. And I would like to answer many questions when question and answer period comes up, but I think my time is up.
Thank you, Ella. If you could hold your questions until to the very end, that would be great. Appreciate it. Bill Simmons is going to fill in a little of the context after the period that Ella was talking about, and maybe overlap somewhat.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. First of all, thank you to Mike and Holly for organizing this. And as a Rhode Islander who has lived elsewhere for probably more than half of his life, I have really come to be amazed at the degree to which people in Rhode Island know the places where they live. That is, they know the history of it, they know the background, the stories associated with it. You don't see that. I taught for many years in California, which is a place where I lived in California for many years. It's a place where people come and go. They come from Rhode Island, they go to Hawaii, they come from Washington, they go to New Mexico or whatever. And rarely do you see the sense of people having a sense of belonging and sort of having a sense of pride in their geography. That we just kind of take for granted here in Rhode Island. I guess I'll start with a little anecdote, and that is that my wife and I have a, when our daughter was a little younger, she had a pet bunny. And so during the summer, gets back to what Ella said about the seasons, during the winter, the bunny stayed in the house. We had a little kind of a cage in the house, and And during the winter, we had a cage out in the yard, and we called the cage out in the yard Matunik. In the summer, the bunny went to Matunik. So it sort of keeps up that Narragansett pattern of moving to the shoreline in the summer and then moving back into the interior in the winter. I got interested in early Narragansett and early Rhode Island colonial history and prehistory as a child. And I became absolutely enchanted by archaeology, and that is by the realization that there was still the material culture, the stone technology of the Narragansett, everywhere you could look around us. I mean, it was everywhere. And so by the time I was old enough to ride a Red Columbia bike here and there around Providence, Cranston, Warwick, and so forth, I became enchanted with looking for Native American arrowheads. And so I began to ride around. And I found that up here in Patuxent, for example, Cole's Farm is one example, there were Indian Narragansett historical and archaeological remains everywhere you could look. They were everywhere. There were shell middens, there were stone artifacts and so forth. The same thing, you go down the coast a little bit to Shawmut, and the same thing, the fields there were absolutely, the gardens and fields were absolutely filled with Native American artifacts. There was a place where the trestle crossed this West Shore Road as you leave Appanagh to go towards Conimicut. And to the left of that trestle, as you go underneath the bridge, there's an area there. There's a little brook that goes through it, Sweet Meadow Brook, I think it's called. And the whole shoreline of that brook for probably a half a mile or so was shelved. It's all been excavated out. I don't know what happened to it. It was a construction project or something for concrete. I have no idea what it was. But in any event, it was a huge archaeological settlement of generations and generations and generations of Narragansetts and their predecessors, going back who knows how far in time. But in my explorations into the interior, you'd find archaeological sites, you would find material remains, but you'd find them farther between. That is, the settlements were spread out. But once you get to the coast, you could hardly go 100 yards in one direction or another without finding continuous evidence of Narragansett occupation, which just bears out what Ella was saying about the seasonal cycle, where during the summer they lived along the coast, and then during the winter they would move into the interior into condensed villages. But the spaces between those villages, because they were places where they went for hunting, were quite great. And so although you find concentrations of settlements in one place, another place, another place, nothing like what you find along the shorelines. It was very densely settled during the summer months. In thinking about the whole issue of shoreline in the 17th century, it occurred to me that to the Narragansett, it probably was not only the good season, as Ella says, the summer was not only the good season, but the shoreline was the good place. That the shoreline itself and the villages along the shoreline had a certain kind of significance to them. I suppose each season had its significance, but I think one of the ways in which the significance of the shoreline showed up among the Narragansett was that they had sacred sites along these shorelines. And one of them, for example, would be the Mark Rock in Conimicut. I don't know how many of you have seen that, but not too far from Conimicut Point, there is a very large stone right on the edge of the water, and that stone, the surface of that stone, is completely covered with pictographic figures. And these pictographic figures certainly, without any doubt, have to do with mythological stories, having to do with the creation, having to do with the culture heroes that lived in this area, that walked to the giants, that walked along the coastline at the time of shortly after the first Narragansett creation. If you go over to Bristol along the shoreline again on the other side of Mount Hope Neck, there's another huge rock with all kinds of photographs on it, exactly in the same place, right at the high tide, low tide mark, lying right at the edge of the sea. And it's where they chose to record their mythical stories. And if any of you, this is a slightly different area, but it's across Narragansett Bay. It's not far away. It's still in the same general area. There is the Dighton Rock. Many of you may have seen that. There are lots of different arguments about what the Dighton Rock is about and what it represents and so forth. It's said to have been done by Vikings. It's said to have been done by Portuguese navigators.
and so forth, but there's no question that the Dighton Rock, in fact, was another inscription rock right on the edge of the shoreline where the Native Americans who lived in that area recorded the symbols and the stories that were important to them. So I think there's plenty of evidence that the shoreline was not only a safe and comfortable place where people lived during the winter, but I mean during the summer rather, but also a place that had certain meanings and significance to them. The earliest detailed accounts in written accounts, historical accounts we have of the Narragansett people came through the writings of Roger Williams. And I'm wondering how many of you have ever looked at Roger Williams' Key to the Language of America. Are you familiar with this book? It was written in 1643. Roger Williams arrived in Rhode Island in 1636. He learned to a certain extent to speak the Narragansett language. And in one of his trips to England in 1643, he wrote down what he knew, and he wrote this little story. It's a book that has a number of chapters. And in these chapters, he wrote page after page of Narragansett vocabulary, and then he also wrote accounts of different aspects of the ways in which they lived their lives. He wrote an account of, for example, how they built their houses, how they worked their gardens, how they hunted, how they counted, how they kept track of the seasons, what their government was, what their family relations were, and so forth, the ways they greeted each other. He has chapters on all of these subjects. And I thought, just for your interest, I would read what Roger Williams had to say about the beach, the shoreline. He says, of fish and fishing. Diverse parts of the country abound with this fish, which is a sturgeon. Yet the natives, for the good part, for the goodness and greatness of it, much prize it, and will neither furnish the English with so many nor so cheap that any trade is likely to be made of it till the English themselves are fit to follow the fishing. So they had their favorite fish that they would neither give nor trade to the English. The natives venture one or two in a canoe with a harping iron or such like instrument to stick this fish and so hale it into their canoe. Sometimes they take them by their nets, which they make of strong hemp. If you walk along the shoreline in many places and you know what to look for, you can still find the sinkers that held these nets. There's a little place in Jamestown, for example, a place called Cain's and Abel's Island, as you go across the little sort of causeway that leads to Beavertail. Those little islands, if you wade out there at low tide, you can find stone sinkers that the Narragansetts used to sink the bottom halves of their nets just all over the place. Another fish. Of this fish there is abundance, which the natives dry in the sun and smoke, and some English begin to salt. Both ways they keep all the year, that is, so they could, by salting and keeping it for the summer. It is hoped may be well accepted as cod at a market, and better if once known. Whales in some places are often cast up. I have seen some of them, but not above 60 foot long. The natives cut them out several parcels and give them far and near for an acceptable present or dish. Then he talks about a clam called Sikaswa, which I guess is the soft-shell clam. This is a kind of sweet shellfish which all Indians generally over the country, winter and summer, delight in. And at low water, the women dig for them. This fish and the natural liquor of it, that is the juice, they boil, and it makes their broth and their nosamp, which is a kind of thickened broth, and their bread seasonable and savory instead of salt. And for that, the English swine dig, and that is for the clams, the English swine dig and root these clams wheresoever they come and watch the low water. Therefore, of all English cattle, the swine, because of their filthy disposition, are the most hateful to the natives. They call them filthy cutthroats. So in other words, the English swine would walk up and down the coast digging up, rooting up clams and eating them. As far as the Native Americans here, the Narragansetts, were concerned, that was basically, you know, eating their summer meal. I'll periwinkle and then I'll stop. Of which they make their wampum, or white money, of half the value of their sucker walk, or black money, of which more in that chapter on coin. So not only was the seacoast important from the point of view of food, but it was also important from the point of view of the currency and the jewelry that the Narragansett manufactured out of the shells of the different quahogs and various other types of periwinkle what do you call the shells that turn around like that? Whorls? Anyway, the Narragansett made jewelry out of those, and they also made their purple and white beads out of those. So there are many, many things that could be said about the coastline. But I think that one of the most interesting is the degree to which Narragansett place names have survived in the memories and to the present day. I don't think you could walk from Providence to Westerly without knowing being able to find out the Narragansett name for that place, if you think about it. If you're going from Providence, the east side basically was known to the Narragansett as Tot Wharton. If you got across the river, that was known as Weibosset. You go down the river a little bit farther. I don't know, I can't remember what's in between Weibosset and Patuxet, but let's jump over to Patuxet. Then you go from Patuxet to Shawmut to Conimicut to what? Quidnesset to Potawamet. You could go all the way along the Rhode Island coastline, and the Narragansett names for those locations are still there in our minds. We still use them even today, which is really unusual. I don't know of another place in the country that has the Indian vocabulary, the indigenous Indian vocabulary, in a sense, still kind of like right there in the landscape and still commonly in use. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. What we call Salter Grove now is called Chappaquonset. In fact, that was the name of the country club that was there for quite a while, was Chappaquonset Country Club. So, Don, could you...
I think you can probably hear me, too. I'm used to... it's great. You know, it seems to me that the more we talk, the more you realize how much everybody seems to be drawn to the sea, especially in the summertime. And Warwick, you know, was really the place to go, especially in the mid-19th century. But even before that, the early settlers came, and, of course, they settled along the coastline at Connecticut and that area there. And then, you know, they did that because it was, you know, easy to travel by water than it was any other way, and because of the trading that they could do, you know, up and down the coast. And so from the very beginning, really, we find that most of the early settlements were here, and as they, you know, get more and more populous, they begin to move further inland. The early days, of course, they were mostly farmers, but they also found themselves trading. And I think as time went on, you found more and more that the older son would inherit the farm, and the younger sons, in order to make a living, would turn very often to the sea. So places like we're talking about, in Warwick especially, this was very, very important. And as time went on in the 18th century, early 18th century, we begin to see Warwick ships going further and further around in what we call the coastal trade. And they would be trading, you know, from Rhode Island, going out on the islands and getting themselves, you know, a pretty good cargo. Then they would take it down, maybe trade with, you know, South Carolina or along the coast and eventually get to the West Indies. And in time, of course, we have what is, you know, known as the triangular trade, where they would go from here, you know, to the West Indies and then to Europe and Africa and get slaves. And we had, you know, that kind of a trade going here. So very early, this is what was happening. The area we're talking about now, pretty much, was part of the early Arnold and Rhodes family that came down in this area. And this is where they began to, you know, work in through here. And Patuxet, of course, was a big seaport, as was Appanagh at the time. It seems kind of funny now to realize that Appanagh, you know, was a big port and the largest ships could come in and everything else. But they did. They would have, the Green family had, you know, a lot of trade going in here. They brought in the black sand, you know, for their forges and all that type thing. So historically, it's always been, you know, that kind of an area. And I think everybody knows probably the big highlight in 1772, you know, was when the Gaspe was grounded off Nanquid Point, which is at the southern tip of the area we're talking about here. And this, you know, really was, I think, a very, very significant part of our history, because I think it's the first act of, you know, openly act of violence that we have in the American Revolution, because they did burn a British ship. There's no two ways about it. I don't see how you can get around it. What they did, though, you know, was trying to appease everything. They didn't want to blow this thing up. I think the British pretty much felt that, you know, if they could keep this under wraps and if they could, you know, put the blame on somebody, you know, maybe it would blow over. But as you well know, it didn't cause the stir that the Boston Tea Party did or anything like that, but it certainly was very significant because it did get the committees of correspondence writing, and it was definitely the idea that we were feeling to that point where we were beginning to break further and further away with England. And so this was a big significant thing. So if nothing else, you know, this area here would be famous, I think, in my own way, for the burning of the Gaspe. But things went on. It was even different than that as time went on, because with the big trade coming in, and Patuxent became a big customs port after the Revolutionary War, trade was going on all over the world, really, from Rhode Island, and we began to get more and more of this trade coming in. Then as time changed in the 19th century, steamboats began coming into the bay. And as they did, you know, they would come down from Providence usually, looking for a good place, you know, where they might be able to stop and have a picnic. A lot of them were Sunday school excursions that were coming out. And that's how Rocky Point started, you know, in 1842, I believe, or 47, I'm not too sure right now. But basically, Captain Winslow was looking for a good place to stop to have a Sunday school picnic, and, you know, Rocky Point was beautiful. So we did get there and eventually bought it. And this set up a whole lot of other things. People began to say, wow, Warwick was the place to go in the summertime, you know, and for a long time it really was. And we had all these different groups growing up. You're talking about Mark Rock. There was a Mark Rock Hotel. Mark Rock Hotel, however, was notorious. It was a horrible place for the drinking and all the rest of the stuff that goes on. When they would pull in Mark Rock and the Sunday excursion, all kinds of things would happen, fights and you know what. And when they came back into Providence, the police would be waiting there. They just dragged the drunks off, you know, and put them away, so that kind of thing. So what was happening was Warwick was, on the one hand, considered to be, gee, a nice place in the summertime for Sunday school picnic, but, you know, do we really want our kids, you know, going there? And is this really a good environment? So pretty soon what was happening was that various groups were beginning to say, well, maybe we should have our own, you know, place away from, you know, Rocky Point. Rocky Point wasn't that bad, but away from Mark Rock, certainly. They didn't like the amusements and all that. So we had places cropping up like Buttonwoods, you know, which came from a Baptist church, I believe, and they had their own rules and their own places. And I think Buttonwoods is still one of the best-kept secrets in Rhode Island, you know, for a real nice place. And then, too, around this area here, we had different groups coming into the area, and especially a lot of Swedes. And they begin to find, you know, coming in, a lot of them were living in Patuxent, and they find that, you know, they could come down into this area. And we're talking about the country club. You know, this was a great idea. Around, I would say, the late 1800s, golf caught on. You know, baseball did too, but baseball had kind of a bad reputation. These were the rowdies that were coming in, you know, that kind of thing. But the golf club came in, and they did have a pretty good golf club, and it worked out for quite a while, and the Nicholas Brown, I believe, had a big mansion there, and then he sold it, you know, that. Henry Brown, I wish he were here, because he has this stuff right at his fingertips, you know. Most of what I know about it, I get from Henry Brown anyhow. So when we hear his tape, I'm sure you'll get a lot more information. But basically, what was happening, too, is that a lot of people were saying, well, you know, we can't afford the big houses or whatever, and people began to say, well, all right, why don't we lease the land and let people put tents up? And so we had all along the coast these little tent villages, sort of. Tents come in, and, you know, you could come down pretty soon. The trolley came in. It was relatively easy to come from Providence or other areas to get to Warwick's coastline. And, wow, this was pretty nice. You know, you could set the tent up for the few months of the summertime. And a lot of times what would happen would be the women and the children would come down, you know, and the men would still be working and come down and, you know, join them on the weekend. I think the same thing happens in Narragansett and places like that today, you know. And from the tents, they went to building simple cottages. And, you know, from a lot of them from the simple cottages, they went on and they built, you know, permanent winter houses. And the whole area began to get pretty much in that sense. So I think that, you know, basically, from my point of view anyhow, the historical aspect from, you know, the farming and the trading, we had the main trading area was through Warwick Neck over to Newport, because Newport, you know, was doing a heck of a lot of trade, and they were the largest city in the area. And so we would begin to trade in that sense across there. We even had a ferry that would go across from Warwick over to Newport to bring the goods. Revolutionary War changed an awful lot of that. What happened with the Revolutionary War, the British fleet came in, and they stopped that trade between Warwick and Newport. So the result was we went inland, and Appanagh, you know, became the place where they we would trade, you know, Post Road, the old Indian path. Maxwell May is a good friend of mine, too. He says, you don't know what Appanagh actually means. place of the traffic jam, you know, so that's about the size of it. That's the way it is now, but at one time, of course, it was the area. So basically, Warwick, you know, built up that way, and then Oakland Beach, we were the place that, you know, for many, many years. Now, you know, Rocky Point is closed down, Narragansett Parkway has come in, Rock Island houses are no longer there, you know, Warwick Downs, pretty much, those houses are no longer there. The Swedish community, still a number of houses that they had built would still be in around, I guess it's Scandia Road and, you know, a few places in there. But basically it has changed, and what was, you know, one time a big summer colony pretty much has taken over the Narragansett housing development and it moved right in. So Warwick has changed over the years, but it's still the fascination of, you know, the water is still very, very strong, and I think you all can see that from Connecticut, Warwick Neck, or wherever. That's about all I have to offer at this point.
Thank you, Governor. If you get a chance afterwards, you should come up and see the model of the cottage here that was made for March Degnan. That was the cottage, an exact replica of a cottage that she and her family had for the summertime after the tents were replaced by cottages, and it's amazing. You can still see, as Don said, some of the summer cottages, now year-round houses, on the north side of the Narragansett condominiums there on the hill. Those weren't raised, but
the rest of them were raised.
You mentioned Rock Island. The hurricane of 38 would have removed the houses on Rock Island, but I think about 4 years earlier they were taken down to make way for some of the other development there.
I think 1933. 1933 was a big year for them to come in, and the Narragansett Parkway, and so they took a lot of the houses. And, you know, things had changed, too. The old idea of the trolleys coming down and people coming down, that changed with the coming of the automobile, too.
Yeah, well, in the mid-19th century up and through the 20th century, that area became more and more recreational in nature, from swimming and baseball fields and the assembly hall and the bingos and all of that stuff. Henry did a good job, and so did Bill Ruggieri and other people, talking about that time frame. And we have them on the tape, so if you come back to the exhibit and you can hear the voices talking, you'll hear a lot of that more recent history or oral history. Unfortunately, Henry Brown can't share his vast knowledge with you. We're going to hear a few minutes of him just talking about that period when the cottages were being raised and the hurricane came in. So I recommend, in lieu of hearing Henry talk about it, find his book in the library that he co-wrote with Hazel Kennedy, called Warwick Downs, A Sense of Place, 1638 to 1972. Mm-hmm. So if Holly can push the button, we may be able to hear.
And not five wood, but there were great cheap bombs. So what? They were having a grand party one time in 1896 or 7 in early spring. It was a loose joint in the furnace. The entire place went up in flames and burned to the ground.
The first country club, the Nicholas Brown.
They lost the clubhouse, but they still continued as a golf course for a number of years. And the golf course ran down around an area called Salt Park. Or when I was growing up, it was just Warwick Downs. After the fire, the Warwick Downs community began to expand, and these campsites then developed into the campsites, the cottages. There were about 30 or 40 of these little cottages on an area known as the Downs. In 1905, there was a Parks Recreation Expansion Program. One of the areas under consideration for the Spock Rhode Island Park system was Salted Grove. So they had enough money available to construct Narragansett Parkway, and they purchased from the country club folks the area known as Salted Grove. Now, this once they purchased it, the people had cottages on the property were squatters. They had a lease that probably ran from season to season or month to month. The state then requested these houses removed. So about 30, 35 of these little cottages that dotted the entire landscape over there were demolished. That was all demolished by 1925. I think they removed all the houses by 1925. There weren't any houses in it. They took that. I counted them on the map.
Well, I'm sorry I can't hear Henry in person, but I would like to open it up if people have some questions or comments to any of our wonderful participants here tonight.
The Salt, excuse me, the Salt family still lives in Ward, I understand. Have they contributed to the information on the renaming of Salt Grove?
Right. Yeah, Jennifer Wilde, I guess, is a granddaughter of George B. Salter.
Yeah. And I'm another.
Another.
Wilde?
Yes.
And they did share some information. I think especially riding on a fire truck that he would get from one of the local fire stations and annually take the kids around for a ride on the fire truck because he was, I think, one of the early fire commissioners who consolidated the fire departments.
Yes, he was actually a very prominent citizen. He was a councilman. He was an executive vice president of the Providence Washington Insurance Company. Mm-hmm. He was the fire and police safety commissioner. And he was a volunteer fireman, which is why he had access to that fire truck. That's one of the great memories of his eight grandchildren is being taken on rides on the fire truck round. But that was just one endearing quality. He was a very, very nice man and very well loved.
The park was named for him, or dedicated in his honor in 1967, I believe.
Yes, he died in 1966,
right,
at the age of 64.
And I think Jennifer said it was pretty ironic because he loved to go to that place just for the peaceful feeling that you get by sitting there looking at the nature and the wildlife and the water. And I guess when they dedicated the park to him, they weren't really aware of his fondness for the place. So it was kind of just one of those happy coincidences that it happened.
You know, I drove my grandmother down there often after he died and after it was dedicated to him. But we'd go and just drive the car down and sit in the car and look out at the water. And she really enjoyed that spot.
People still do that.
I lived around the corner from George Salter at that time. He lived on Lawrence Street.
Yes.
And he had a son named Warren.
Yes, my father.
That's your father?
Yes.
Tell him back to me, I said hello.
Hi.
I haven't seen Warren in 50 years.
But he's still here in Warwick.
Yeah, that's good.
The memorial bench that's in the Grove, has been mentioned, that's my son. And we scattered his ashes there at the Grove, so it's a very, very important spot to me, too.
George's ashes were scattered there?
No, my son.
Oh, your son. Oh.
Yes.
The summer, was it your sense that the Narragansetts lived on the islands in the eastern part of the bay, too, or mainly the western part of the bay?
Every square mile you could think of all along the coastal, where people from inland, even though they might have been 30 or 40 miles inland, there was a certain time that they would come to the saltwater area where they could take advantage of what was offered there.
The east coast as well?
Yep. Yes. In fact, for the amazing thing about Patuxet, the Narragansett people who lived in that particular area used to summer in what became known as New Plymouth or Plymouth. That's where a part of the Patuxet Narragansett would summer. They had a different place than staying just in what was to become Rhode Island.
You know, I'm curious about
the
Narragansett were a matriarchal society.
Yes.
And I was wondering what kind of, that's pretty far back, what kind of authority women had as a matriarchal society.
They had the same equality as the men. They weren't looked upon and they weren't owned as the European men, women and children were owned by the men. They had their things which belonged to them personally, where the people that came from Europe, the man owned the homes, the tools, the utensils, the weapons, the children, the women, the cots, the animals, they owned everything.
That's seems to me that in a matriarchal society, the mother of a family has the authority in running the family. Is that the way it works?
You had the early years where the children were nursed for 3 winters, and then they were in charge. They were left in charge of usually the older females and their mother until they got to a certain age, 8, 9, or 10 years old, and then they would start to be taught the male things. So, and as far as the homes were concerned, the men built the frames to the house. Everybody pitched in and made the various mats and other things that would go on the outside and the inside of the house. The men would be stripping the trees for the longhouses, for the bark that would go on them for the final covering. So it was a thing of respect. There was respect that was put there and was extremely important. And that's where there was the equality. And where we always figured the backbone of the communities was because a man was entitled to have as many wives, because the women outnumbered the men, as many wives as he could keep meat in the pot for. So sometimes he'd have 2 or 3 wives. And as long each one would have their own wigwam, or whatever you wanted to call it, and they would the men would be responsible for making sure that there was always meat to go in the pots of those 3 places. And there didn't seem to be a problem with that, but in the 20th century, being a 20th century person, I thought as long as I was the elder wife, I wouldn't mind. Because that would be who would have a little more authority than the younger wives.
Do you have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering, in the state of Rhode Island, what's the earliest evidence, I guess maybe it's archaeological evidence, of early occupation Native Americans? I just wonder how far back is it?
Well, so far they have gone back right around 20,000 years, depending upon Southern New England and how far they have had examples of it. I think Getting was the one that did some work in when they were putting in the tunnel in Boston, and the materials that were dug out carbon?
Boylston Street.
What did they do to tell the age?
Carbon.
Yeah, the carbon thing. So that was 20,000 years. But then you have to take into consideration exactly that hypothetical land bridge type of thing. And there's so many others. Even today, I watched Animal Planet, and they're talking about, they are sure that certain types of animals came across on the land bridges, but we evolved here, and what most people forget is that equator goes all around the earth to make conditions for the evolution of different types everywhere, not only in one place. You read some of the old books, and there was nothing here except vast nothings. From all types of animals, birds, plants, the whole thing, which we know is illogical.
That's a question. You mentioned something about sweet water earlier. I wasn't sure what that was.
Fresh water.
Okay, I thought you said fresh and salt, and then you said sweet.
Yeah, well, that's what we referred to as the sweet water was the fresh water.
I have 2 disparate questions. One is, when was the jetty at Walworth Downs or Salta Cove built? And also, were the Narragansetts bothered by ticks?
By ticks? Yes, they were.
Lyme disease twice.
Yes, they were. And there was something that was in the Earth Mother that protected them against what is bothering people today. And some of us, depending upon our lines and of who we are, we're not bothered by certain things. And I'm one of the fortunate people, although I have two kids that were bitten by ticks, and they had the Lyme disease. But I have had, because of my work out there in the field, even as old as I am, going over hill and dale and picking ticks off my clothes and everything else, and I've had the tests, and I've been very fortunate. And living in the woods as a kid, we must have been bit by ticks, one thing or another, but we had that old medicine, as we call it, so we didn't get sick from it.
Breakwater, 1965.
And what's a body of water? Is there a name for the body of water inside of that?
Do you know, Ed?
They call the outer cove.
There was the north and the south cove.
Yeah, yeah.
Separated now by the...
Well, we need some...
Causeway.
We need some flushing of that cove.
Right.
Causeway.
Well, they built the causeway, which allows you to get out to the breakwater in Rock Island and Marsh Island when they were building the breakwater, that mile long.
Isn't there a pipe or something?
There is. It's silted up. It's been silted. They've never flushed it.
Okay.
It's silted up.
We've been working on a project for years, trying to get somebody to do something about making it permanent.
Originally, they were going to remove the causeway once the breakwater was built.
Okay.
But people like the access so much because it's such a great area to go out to and just to fish or do whatever you want. They left it.
Over.
Well, there is one, but then below it, you don't get any flushing from the upper, from the north side into this. So it's a pollution problem. We'd like to get the flow or flushing out of there. With the highs and the low tides. So we're still working on it. That's still a project that we're talking to our representative, Joe McNamara, about. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to flush it out or just leave it there?
No, we want the tides to come in and out.
Mm-hmm.
The lower part of the south part of the cove, the outer basin, is kind of landlocked. The channel into the cove is...
It's blocked up.
It's very narrow, and it's just for boating. It is more than 75 or 100 feet wide. It needs flushing, and it did have flushing once upon a time.
Well, some of us dislike seeing change. I'll have a fit the next time we're coming up the coast to come home from Washington, D.C., or in that particular road where you're used to at certain times to see the bridges and one thing or another, and now one of them's gone.
Yeah.
For landmarks. So.
Well, there's so many people involved. There's the City of Warwick, the Natural Resources, the federal government involved, and you got all these parties that have a voice in the matter that it's hard to get them to work together to do something.
Well,
we've got a committee or a voluntary committee that just keep pushing, and one day, hopefully, it'll happen.
Yeah. The land is actually owned by the state, but leased to the city for a dollar a year, I think, because they didn't want to get involved in trying to, if they sold it or gave it to Warwick, the state, according to the original contract of taking the houses, would have to go back to the people who owned the land, and they would have the first right to repurchase the land, and they didn't want to open that particular.
We had a couple of drowning people at high tide trying to get out to the fishing area on the causeway or the breakwater. And they tripped and fall, jumping from one rock to another.
Many people have been stranded out there at high tide.
Yeah, you get out there in cold weather, you don't want to walk in cold water.
Right.
And people saying, at low tide, don't go there because that's my land. Get off.
Did you have a question, Bill?
I was wondering, Princess Redwing, you knew her. Could you tell us something about her?
Yes, I knew her well, but she wasn't a member of any of the tribal groups here in the north. Her people came from Culpeper, Virginia. And because of her association with the Narragansett, and she was a woman who was educated and able to help with the publishing of articles and one thing or another. Yes, I knew her very well.
Did she represent the Narragansett at the United
what?
Nations? Did she represent the Narragansett at the United Nations?
She may have, but she claimed to be other things, but when the genealogy was done and the old-timers knew that she was not and her people were not from this place. And as tribal genealogists, I have done at least 4,000 genealogies for people. And when you go back 11, 12 generations and you find nothing that belongs in this particular area, you can't claim it. You can't claim Narragansett, Mohegan, Pequot, Skagit, Long Island, or any of those tribes.
But that Pawtucket means the Great Falls, that area below the Slater Mill. Pawtuxet means the land of the Little Walls or something of that nature.
Yeah.
I've only heard that Pawcatuck means no falls.
Yeah, the place of the falls.
That's true.
Yes.
Yeah.
And as far as the Pawtuxet, it had to do with water as well. And in many cases, a lot of the names that are used, a lot of the Indian names that are used, it's only a portion of the name that's being used.
I've heard Professor Simmons talk about how the names aren't just the name of a place, but they usually have a myth behind them that evolved over a long time.
There's always the myths and the legends that go with the places. One of my great mysteries is to do more research on the little people, which in every country in the world is there references to the little people. And I believe in one place in Virginia, they found some of the graves of the little people. And then, of course, we have names for the existence, but there's little people all over the world. And the most noted today are the pygmies of certain places. Not dwarfs, but pygmies.
There's references to giants, too, aren't there?
Well, there were always the reference of the giant spirits and the giant people. In some of the archaeological digs that have gone on, in one place, they came across a skull. Have you seen that skull, Bill? It's immense. It's twice as big as, or almost twice as big as a large man's skull. And it still had some of the hair on the scalp. And they haven't found any of the other bones that go with that, but that was one of the, what I would refer to as giants. And they figured from the size of the skull that the man must have been at least 9 or 10 feet tall. And the Narragansett were a tall people, but there weren't that many to that extent. Today we have 7-footers in the tribe. And tall people. I have a sister-in-law that's 6 feet two, and I have two daughters that are 6 feet tall. Tall people, but for the giant part of it, that's where I think the myths and the legends come in. Where there's been an unexplainable, probably a dinosaur track or something.
Yeah,
What do you think about it, Bill?
Well, I think that's right. there are many stories about, Roger Williams actually makes a reference to it. A
Marsh
giant
up.
By the name of, he had two different names. One was Wetux, which I guess was his name. And he was also known as Mashup, which is basically the Narragansett word for a big man. And there are stories from Long Island, along the Rhode Island coast, along Cape Cod's coast, Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket, of the activities of this giant and the ways in which he sculpted the landscape to make the terrain there safe for people to live in. And in doing that, he drove away monsters. For example, there's a story that there was a giant hawk that lived on Nantucket who flew into Cape Cod and would capture children and take them out to the island to its nest and eat them. And so the giant walked out from Cape Cod to Nantucket and had a struggle with the giant bird and killed it with his axe. And then he found the skeletons of all of these children lying there on the landscape. And if you ever visit the community of Gay Head in Martha's Vineyard, there's a lighthouse there, and there are some cliffs. And in those cliffs, there are a lot of different colors of stratified clays.
Mm.
And there are fossil whale bones, and there are old charcoal and shells, and there's all kinds of stuff. It's a really interesting geological deposit. And the people of Gay Head, the Wampanoags of Gay Head, say that that's where the giant, that's one of the places where the giant lived, and that these stratified remains that you can find in the cliff and the whale bones and whatnot are the relics of his campsite, the things that he left behind after killing all the whales and seals and other sea creatures that lived out in that area. And they also explain stone causeways, that is, places where it's difficult to navigate because there are boulders close to the surface, as being where at some point he began to build a bridge from the island to the mainland and never finished it for some reason. And it's still out there as a kind of a danger. And the people of Gay Head still explain fogs, for example, and loud noises that are heard in the fogs in terms of the activities of the giant who's believed to still be out there someplace. There's this wonderful story about his activities around Westerly by the mouth of the Pocatuck River where he went hunting bears, and bears were in the tree, and so he managed to get the bears out of the tree by beating the tree with his club, and the bears all fell out, and he caught them, you know, ate them and so forth. So I think as we look at the landscape of Narragansett Bay, for example, I think you could pretty much assume that these places had stories about them. That is, they have stories that go back to the beginning of time. And one example of that, for example, the giant Mashup on Martha's Vineyard, according to one legend that was recorded from a Gay Head person around 1800, 1790 or thereabouts, was that the giant had an argument with his wife and threw his wife to the mainland. The Narragansett word in Roger Williams' key for the women's god is Squant. And the giant's wife's name was Squant. And he threw her to the mainland. And according to the story, you can see her there still today in the form of a stone off Secaunet Point. And as you may know, there was a Native American group that lived there in the 17th century known as the Secaunets. And there's that rock out there on Secaunet Point. And that rock is Squant, the wife of the giant. But Secaunet, Squant, these are all just in English sort of like hearings and writings of the same word. So you look at this rock off the edge of Secaunet, which is named for the giant's wife, and is believed to be the giant's wife turned into stone. It gives you just kind of a little taste of what the rest of the landscape probably looked like, what the rest of the landscape probably meant to people. And I wondered about the name of Connemicut. Connemicut was the granddaughter of Connemicus?
Yes. Yes.
The place is named for her. She was a sachem. Part of your question is that there were women sachems among the Narragansetts as well as men sachems. So that is either males or females could be the tribal leaders. But in any event, Connemicut was the Narragansett sachem. She was the granddaughter of Connemicus, who was the leader of all of the Narragansett tribes and subjects at the time of the English arrival here in Rhode Island. That place is named for her. And I would be really interested, and I don't know how anyone could ever figure this out, but since that was her place, that's where she lived, and she was named, and it was named for her, I would be really interested to see what it was that was written into Mark Rock, the place where she lived. What is the story, what is the legend that's connected with that person, with that name? I'm sure there is one.
Yes, when they talk about things being written in stone, there were the clan marks that were written in stone in the different places, all along the coast and inland, and in some cases where there were groups and clans of certain people, the marks are written in stone.
And also were tattooed on people. There's a painting at the Rhode Island School of Design of the late 17th century sachem Ninigrin. It's a wonderful painting. It's one of the earliest of paintings done in New England of anybody. Anyway, it hangs in the Rhode Island School of Design Museum. If you look closely at Ninigrin's painting, he has a tattoo on his leg. That tattoo is a kind of a symbol. I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, I'm sure that it identified his family. That is his particular family crest.
Nearly everyone had a tattoo, and it was either on your cheek or on your shoulder, front or back, and that was like your birth certificate because it showed which clan you were originally from. And as far as people and their names, the right to the places. When a man married a woman, he went to the woman's place of living and became known as one of those people henceforth. And that's why people have a problem. And in doing the genealogies of our people, when they went into Massachusetts and when they went into what became Connecticut, then things changed. They're from that group, so they're such and such a thing. Was there what?
Was there a sense of organization in terms of who got what part of the shoreline?
Well, yes, there had to be, and you stayed in a specific area for your habitation for 2 or 3 years, and then you would let the ground where you had your gardens rest for 2 or 3 years, and you would move elsewhere. And because there was plenty of space, when you stop to think of the population and how people live today, it instead of them being spread out today, they go up.
There's a passage in Roger Williams on that. It says, the natives are very exact and punctual in the bounds of their lands, belonging to this or that prince or people, even to a river, brook, etc. So rivers and brooks tended often to be the boundaries. And I have known them make bargain and sale amongst themselves for a small piece or quantity of ground. Then he adds to that, notwithstanding a sinful opinion amongst many Christians that have right to heathen lands, but the delusion of that phrase I have spoke of in a discourse concerning the Indian's conversion. Roger Williams is the only English person at that time who recognized that the Native Americans had land rights to their own land. One of the assumptions of colonization was that the Native Americans didn't own the land. That it was therefore free to take because they were given permission to take it by the King of Spain or the King of France or the King of England. And therefore they had a written deed to the land, and that deed was all that was required. What distinguished Roger Williams from the rest of that mentality was that he argued, and one of the reasons why he was thrown out of Massachusetts, argued, no, it's not the land of the King of England at all, it's the land of the people who are living there.
And it didn't belong, our people always felt that the land was there and granted, but it never belonged to persons. It still belonged to the Creator, and you were supposed to take care of the land because it meant your survival. And that's why you become part of it when you're going from one part of your life into the afterlife, etc. The earth part where you live on is like your mother. So you couldn't buy or sell.
What did Chaka Kwanzaa mean?
It meant fields at the boundary place. At least that's one translation. I think there's several related ideas.
I brought all the dictionaries I have of translations of local place names.
So obviously what we call Salter Grove or Warwick Downs was an important boundary area too. It's recognized as separating some lands.
And there are still people that have the same idea. For instance, one of our people who recently died, she was in the old style cremated, and her ashes were put in this Warwick specific area.
Jen?
I wondered if there was a specific name for that Warwick Downs.
Besides Chaka Kwanzaa.
Chaka Kwanzaa.
Yeah.
So what is Warwick Downs?
The Downs is an interesting term. It means kind of uplands. I know, it comes from Celtic, so it's not a direct, you know, it doesn't come from downs, from the English word down. It comes from a Celtic word that sounds like down.
Oh, dune.
Dune, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Darn, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah, hills in Scotland Island were called dunes.
And a historian told me that he remembers seeing an old map that showed not only Washington Park, which was a racetrack, which is why Washington Park is called Washington Park, but there was a racetrack in the near Patuxent. And he's trying to find that map for me because I've never seen or heard of that. And Henry Brown never mentioned it. I don't know if Don had ever heard of one, so.
Not that,
no.
So racetracks are called downs, too.
Yeah. Racetracks are downs.
Yeah,
churches
right.
Are downs. Other downs.
So it was Warwick Dunes.
Yeah.
D-O-O-N, not D-U-N-E.
Early
Yeah, I don't know, but I think it was called Warwick Downs by then. But I don't know what they were calling it.
That's my earliest memory, but I don't know if
that's what the streets called when they first came.
Where was the racetrack? It's a good question. I'm not sure it was even there. It's not been documented. It's only in the memory of some historian who thinks he saw it on a map. Which puts it in the realm of oral tradition right now. Yeah. Well,
what respect does it put in? You said oral tradition?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right now, that's all I've heard. It's in word of mouth.
Well, this the basics and the basis of oral tradition is really great. Because it is things that you learn as a child, and you must say it the way it was told to you. And that's how I learned the history of my people and knew people before I ever met them when I was growing up. And with all of the various survival things and what we were taught as medicine people, you had to stand on that proverbial soapbox. If people are old enough here to remember the little soapboxes, and I'll never forget that experience that I had. It was in the wintertime, and it was my turn to stand on that soapbox and to repeat the histories of my mother's clan and my father's clan. And I made a mistake, and if you made a mistake, you went right back to the beginning until you repeated it exactly how you were told. And when I began, they had just put some wood in the stove. And I made a mistake, so I had to go back to the beginning and start through it. And by the time I got through, the sweat, not perspiration, but sweat was pouring off of me, and the top of the stove was red. But you can believe I didn't make a mistake that second time. And I remember that night more than anything else, relative to oral tradition. And that was the lesson that was learned relative to oral tradition, because much of it we will clarify if someone has written a little something of it, but still there are oral tradition and oral words and practices that it's still just the business of the people.
Definitely. Well, thank you all. I appreciate your...
Very nice meeting you.
Thank well, it was nice. Much. It was nice for the get together.
Yeah.
And Bill.
Yes, good to hear you.
Bill.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, nice
thank
to meet you. There. How part of the
what
trolley?
What a nice group. Thank you.
Trolley?
Yeah.
Oh, went all the way to Buttonwoods, and then they later on they had to go all the way to Akron.
You had to go to Lakewood.
Yeah. Lakewood.
When you talked about Indian camp.